Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. And I'm very pleased because once again I have Dr. Susan Lee as my guest. We did part one, April the 11th, and now we're going to do part two because Dr. Lee knows so much about human sexuality. She is the clinical director of the Florida Postgraduate Sex Therapy Training Institute, and she has a wonderful background in clinical and research in sexology. She received extensive training with the late Helen Singer Kaplan, MD, PhD at Cornell Medical College. Susan Lee, it's just a pleasure to have you back again. Hello.
Thank you. Hello. Thank you for the lovely introduction.
Well, you deserve it. Not very many of my colleagues, I think you're the only one that I know personally who is trained with Helen Singer Kaplan. That must have been, you must have felt that it was a very unique experience at the time. To be working with such a famous woman. Yes.
It was very unique. Once a week we met with her and she talked her cases. And in those days there was a VCR, a big thick VCR that she used, VHS, and she taped her cases and then spoke about why she made the interventions that she did for sexual health and for sexual well-being. And then the second day that we were there, we worked with patients from the Cornell Medical School and the Payne Whitney Hospital. Now it's New York Hospital. And we work with patients. Something I'm sure you did similarly when you were in California at UCLA.
Yes. But you're doing it also at your institute, and listeners, you can go to floridasextherapyinstitute.org, and then that will give you all the information about the Sex Therapy Institute, Florida Sex Therapy Institute.
Thank you. And I started one last year in New York. We hold it at Columbia University Faculty House.
Mm-hmm.
It is not part of Columbia, but it is a New York training, and it's a two-year training. We do it on Saturdays and Sundays, so it's fun for people to come to New York five times a year. And It's just great to teach this subject. As you know, this is what you do when you have these shows, and I'm ready for your questions and for your listeners to be inspired, hopefully, to, if they are working with patients, to learn how to work with sexual issues, and also if they're interested for themselves.
Yes, and you were saying to me that more and more doctors are signing up, MD doctors are signing up for your graduate course because
right,
they really do want to know how to talk to their patients about sexuality.
Right, because the loss of sexuality is not an inevitable aspect of aging, and it's not an inevitable aspect of being married for a long time or being with the same person for a long time. And physicians want to hear the complaint of something sexual from a patient and be able to respond. That's one piece of it. Those are limited interventions. There are more and more physicians, ever since, I would say, Viagra came out in 98, that are interested in doing the counseling part of the intervention. And historically, it's been psychotherapists or psychiatrists that have done the counseling.
But
it was never the purvey of urologists and gynecologists and internal medicine people, cardiologists. But now, since so many of these physicians are writing script for medications related to sexual health, they want to know more. They want to learn more.
And your institutes, both in Florida and in New York City, provide that sort of training. Susan, I wanted to back up a little bit, because
sure.
one of your learning objectives, one of the educational objectives,
uh-huh.
is to learn the history of sexology, as well as the latest research in sexual medicine. And I think it would be interesting for our listeners
yes.
to hear a little more about Masters and Johnson's work. I mean, when they did their research, they had worked with prostitutes and volunteers who performed
mm-hmm.
more than 10,000 sexual acts in the name of science.
Wow.
And I remember at the time, there was a lot of criticism I've read about it. I don't remember exactly at the time, because they did their research in the 50s
right,
and 60s.
Right.
But they, critics would accuse the pair of dehumanizing sex with their research, of removing its mystery. And, I think that mystery is just another name for superstition and myth. So the more we know about the physiology of arousal, the better we can enjoy the uniquely human experience of sex for pleasure. And I think Masters and Johnson, the timing was right. There weren't as many rules, but they came in and they showed tremendous courage in their research. So that must be, you must look at Masters and Johnson's work as part of the history of sexology.
Well, yes, and the beauty of their work was that people came, a couple would go to St. Louis for 2 weeks,
yeah.
and they had a sexual dysfunction or complaint, and for 2 weeks they were stayed in a hotel and they practiced. They did a lot of scientific understanding, biological understanding, but primarily it was why the mind isn't giving the message to the body to function the way they want it to function. And it was a very exciting time in our history, but as you know, throughout the centuries, men and some women have been interested in how humans function sexually. It's only the last 200 years that people even talked about love. It was more about reproduction and about being pleasured as a man as opposed to women. So a lot has changed since the women's movement, which took place after around the same time as Masters and Johnson. They were very unique in doing scientific studies and recording things. And Kinsey did it more on a clinical research level. He asked people questions. And remember when you first looked at Kinsey and you said, oh, my God, all these people masturbate, all these people like this type of sexual activity, and we were shocked because it was published. Just to go back centuries in Europe, there were always sex therapy institutes, but it was more in the guise of psychiatry or medicine or neurology. And so things started to really happen, certainly in this country, after World War II, when Kinsey came out and then Masters and Johnson. But you actually did research with human beings, right, when you were in Los Angeles, correct?
Yeah.
And there isn't that much going on now. There's not much physical research going on right now.
Well, we didn't observe, of course. Now there are laws that would prevent observing,
uh-huh.
like Masters and Johnson did,
right,
so that they, after their many, many observations, they were able to explain the secrets of orgasm and the power of female sexuality. This gave a real boost to female sexuality. And they also, of course, revolutionized the treatment methods for impotency, as it was called then, or
uh-huh.
erectile dysfunction, premature ejaculation, and other dysfunctions. And did you know, Susan, they coined the term dysfunctions?
Really?
Yeah.
And then I believe along with Helen Singer Kaplan in that era, and Lo Piccolo, and there were so many famous people at the very beginning. They then took all the dysfunctions and put them in DSM. It was DSM-2 or DS, I guess it was DSM-2. And the DSM is for mental disorders. It isn't for physical disorders.
That's true.
So the entire field in those days was thought that if somebody has an erection problem, it's generally because something's going on in their mind that's causing it.
Yes,
it was a mind-body.
Yes. When I was in graduate school 35 years ago, we were taught that it was about 80% mental for impotency and 20% physiological, and now it's exactly the reverse. That is to say, I'm sorry about the sirens, I live close to a...
No, I can hear.
Oh, good. So, because, of course, if a man has physiological problems getting an erection, there is bound to be plenty of emotional overlays.
Well, if you look in the manual of mental disorders, every condition, every dysfunction, male and female, is listed as a mental problem that causes distress. But then each one is listed in another place, sexual dysfunction due to a general medical condition. So if you're in a wheelchair or if you have a physical illness, you have a sexual dysfunction, and so we have to address, as non-physicians, we have to address the psychological underpinnings, teaming up with physicians who deal with the physical problems. Because we have a host of men now coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and they may have emotional problems in their relationships, but because of being injured, they have medical problems too. And so we always have to look at what's going on for them medically. And we know more than we did 35 years ago. Certainly we know that there are certain medical problems that are due to hormones or due to the way the body reacts to illness, and definitely physiological problems, circulation, blood flow. And so we understand that. But I still, I guess, will be... two of the last holdouts, I believe, a lot have to do with the mental attitude and with being relaxed and being and looking at sexual activity as pleasurable rather than something that is a chore.
Yes. When I was at the Susan Sklar Center, and I went there, and I know you trained some of the people, and I looked up the name, and you trained the physician assistant, the PA,
yes.
Jade Singer. Does that name ring a bell, Singer?
Yes, and Teresa. There was another one named Teresa, I believe, that
mm-hmm.
came. But, we spent the weekend talking about how to deal with patients who have sexual dysfunction, sexual problems, and they saw both the medical side, which could be... for women, anyway, many dermatological and intravaginal illnesses. So people have pain during intercourse. They avoid intercourse. And there's a reason for it. It isn't imagined pain. But some women are so tense during sexual lovemaking or sexual activity that they... tense their muscles so tightly that they will feel pain as well.
That's a good point, Susan.
Deciphering what's going on in the mind and then what's going on in the body is something that they can bring back from their doctor or we can speak to their doctor. But I think Masters was a medical doctor. And,
yes, he
and,
was.
And Johnson was a psychologist. And they were highly innovative. The real work began when when people went home and then needed, they had the 2 weeks away and they learned how to please each other, how to function sexually. But then our work began once we realized that it might, people don't live in a 2 week vacation world away from all the stressors of life, and accidents happen and people become ill, and how do, can we treat those people with treatment for sexual problems the same way as they would in a vacuum, so to speak.
Yeah.
Because that was a vacuum. That was, it was perfect for help, for being very helpful. It was, where people will go to workshops for tantric weekends today, how to have magnificent sex weekends. You know, there are these kind of programs that couples can go to and get a lot out of, I imagine. But
well, they do, but they've got to practice when they get home. And some of my couples in my private practice will go to, for instance, a passionate marriage weekend David Snarch, and then they need to continue with the talk therapy with me. They get a lot of intense therapy in Colorado, but it's it needs to be practiced, of course, when they're at home.
Well, the idea of seeing a, let's say we're talking about a couple, and we're evolving now into the fact that in this, and since 1998, there have been a lot of trials with medications for men and women to improve their sexual functioning. And there has been nothing at all that has passed the Food and Drug Administration's rules for females. There's nothing. There has been maybe hormones do, but still, I worked for years on different research projects and products, and nothing for women has passed in the FDA. For men, we have Viagra, Levitra, Cialis, and I believe there's some. I wrote the name down, but I don't have it in front of me. Something that may help men, an application of some type of product that helps men with their sustain their erections that have rapid ejaculation. I don't know if you know the name of that medication, but
I don't know the name, but I do know that a lot of urologists will give men a small dose of an antidepressant.
Right, for the side effects. Because the side effects of an SSRI, for example, is that it slows down your ejaculation. It's harder to have an orgasm, both for men and women. And so they're using the drug off-label. They're prescribing the drug off-label, the medication, where you take the antidepressant every day. You can't just pop it in your mouth and expect to last longer. You have to be on a regimen of medication. It isn't as needed like you would use a lubricant, for example. It's something that's in your body that will slow down your ejaculation, but it also will slow down your interest in sex big time.
Well, that's right, the side effects.
It's given for the side effects. It's given to men with rapid ejaculation as kind of training wheels, and then we would like them to get off of medication and learn how to get the cues themselves to slow down.
And in my practice with rapid ejaculators, we cover a lot of the techniques that they can do by themselves with non-start masturbation, and also with a partner, the female pulling on the man's scrotum. They have to obviously stop if they're having intercourse, and she needs to have him stand, and she can pull down on his balls. That can help.
I've never heard that.
Yes, it does help. And then, of course, the squeeze technique, which I know you've heard of, and all of these things.
What I learned was stop start. And the way I learned it, if a man wants to not have a rapid ejaculation, meaning as soon as he enters, in this case, as soon as he enters the vagina, he ejaculates. as opposed to being able to thrust for a while, whatever a while means for both of them, as long as he wishes would be a nice way to put it, or as long as they wish it, or as long as he wants. But what happens is that he loses track of when the ejaculatory inevitability is there, and he's not aware of the sensations in his body that he's ready to ejaculate. So the behavioral treatment is to teach him to be aware that this is going to happen, and then to stop for a few seconds and then start again, as opposed to squeeze and start. Squeeze is okay, but I'm always afraid to recommend anybody to squeeze somebody's body part, if you know what I mean.
I hear what you're saying. But I think Bernie Zellbergeld first started talking about the stop-start method
right.
30 years ago. And, and at that time, men were encouraged to think about distracting themselves with a baseball game or something. And he said, no, 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 you want to get more in touch with all the sensations inside your penis and really know when you're about to ejaculate. And then change. Maybe you even stop for a moment if you're having intercourse.
A moment.
Yeah. And maybe you change the direction. The man changes the direction of his thrusting.
Or the couple changes position, whether it's
right.
male-male or male-female.
Mm-hmm.
But I read something once that said that teaching the behavioral change for a man to slow it down is like teaching a toddler how to make it to the potty. To know those sensations, a little toddler is going to the potty and he feels he's going to urinate any minute and he gets there. That feeling is a mental awareness that I don't know how he learned it. I don't know how a little toddler learned it. You might know better than me, but somehow they feel that urgency and they wait until they get to the potty. And by the same token, if a man feels, uh-oh, I'm getting ready to ejaculate, the train is going out of the station, then he's got to know that signal and slow it up. Or, as you say, change positions, change thrusting. And once he does that, it's kind of a learned technique. Why men never learn that is really an interesting topic. Why they never learned it in all their years. You know, why don't they slow it up?
I think some men never learn it because they don't read about it, they don't hear about it. They assume they learn bad habits maybe as a teenager.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. For fear of masturbating and being discovered. Kind of goes along with evidence. There have been some studies that show that people who are better educated tend to have more adventuresome sex. And so, you know, you learn more about it. It's one reason that sex therapists, when they're polled, say, yeah, we tend, as a group of sex therapists, we tend to have better sex because we have sex without anxiety. We have more knowledge.
Uh-huh, maybe. Is knowledge power or does anxiety get in the way no matter what? That's a good question.
Well, I think, you know, you can manage anxiety with the right training, with breathing, with mindfulness, you know, being aware of the feelings.
Right.
And letting them go. When I have a low desire woman, she's often thinking about everything else rather than staying focused and mindful. So I suggest that if distracting thoughts come into her head, that she envision those thoughts slowly moving away from her mind on a conveyor belt so that she can come back to center and focus in.
That's very interesting. I like that. I like that visual.
And female sexuality does tend to be more complex, and that's why both at UCLA for me and Susan Sklar Center, you know, traditionally women have had to choose between treatment disciplines when addressing sexual wellness issues. So you could either do the psychological talk therapy or sex therapy, and then or you could do go to a medical doctor, and but many sexual dysfunctions are complex in nature, and they have
roots
that extend to both disciplines, both the medical and the talk.
There's always a psychological reason.
Yes, there is. And
but if it's severe medical reasons, we have to help people understand how that medical or medicine reason is the organicity, whatever it is playing out so that they're avoiding sexual intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
And once people start avoiding sexual intimacy because of a medical problem,
mm-hmm.
it becomes frustrating, distressing, and it may, I mean, your partner may be happy for that you're getting better physically, but people still need to feel wanted and attached, and so we have to think up ways that they can satisfy themselves and each other, I think.
I think one good
medical illness is there. I mean, you know, whether it's a severe illness or something that you can get over rapidly. I think there's so many illnesses that people have today, young and old, and that causes they don't feel like getting it on or getting it off or anything.
Exactly. I'm going to give an example.
Go ahead.
It speaks to what you just said. It's of course common for a menopausal woman to have painful intercourse because of vaginal dryness, and so sometimes her husband is afraid he's going to hurt her, and he avoids intercourse.
Right.
And then some of these women withdraw emotionally because she perhaps feels rejected, and they both distance in their relationship, and they fear they don't love each other the way they once did. So what started out as a very common, straightforward medical problem with a simple lubricant or estrogen topical cream can remedy that, then becomes a complex relationship issue.
Exactly.
And that's what we sex therapists have to deal with, the relationship issue.
I think there's a new show coming on TV, and it's a I don't know the name of it, but I just saw it. It's a reality show, of course.
Yeah.
And it's a show that says that the therapist requests that the couple that they're seeing have sexual activity 7 nights in a row.
Mm-hmm.
And then, obviously, they report back how it's changed their lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing we both know, that if people, not 7 nights, but if people feel that they're having a good time and their body expresses that good time by having an orgasm or and pleasure or being aroused, the fighting stops. The arguing stops. I always see couples get along much better once they are making love. And
absolutely.
Or having sexual intimacy, and yet it's rarely the prescription of the medical doctor. That's why medical doctors want to learn. What do we do with a woman that has vaginal dryness? And, you know, I'm all for hormones myself. I know that the WHI really stopped a lot of women from taking hormones during perimenopause and menopause, but it's really changed the way women look at sexuality and feel physically, and the risk factors of osteoporosis and other types of diseases are there once you stop taking hormones. Certain people can't take hormones because they've had cancer, so we have to really understand the medical side of everybody.
So on that note, Dr. Susan Lee,
yes,
we're going to go to our break.
All right.
And I think after the break, we'll talk a little bit more about HRT and about the multidisciplinary approach, which your institute in Florida addresses so well. And,
Thank you.
We'll talk some more. So stay with us.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
I'm right here.
Good.
I'm going to get it.
We're back. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. And with me is Dr. Susan Lee, the director of the Florida Postgraduate Sex Training Institute. And they offer a course, Medical Sex Therapy. It's a state-of-the-art training program devoted to sexual health. It utilizes medical expertise in conjunction with the principles and practices of sex therapy. We've been talking about that, Dr. Susan Lee and I. We know each other. We're friends.
We're colleagues, right.
Colleagues.
In the same field. Well, medical doctors would love to have the time that sex therapists have. That I see as a major difference in our work. It's not necessarily willful, but as psychotherapists and sex therapists, we would train to sit for an hour with people that come into our office. It could be a 50-minute hour. Some, I usually work for an hour and a half with couples, extend it longer. But physicians are under a very tight schedules because they don't see people for that length of time. And when sex therapy is good, it's that the sex therapist has the luxury of time to sit and listen and understand, and people can express themselves. It's not, I'm watching the clock because I only have 15 minutes and somebody else is coming in. And so the medical sex therapy course is, yes, to understand how medical doctors look at sexual problems, which is great. It's a wonderful training. And I have Dr. Michael Critchman, who's in Newport Beach area. I was not in San Diego, but somewhere.
Yeah, you're right. He is.
Right.
He's in Irvine County. He's in Irvine, I think.
And he is a gynecologist. He also studied oncology. And he's very interested in counseling. And he became a sexuality counselor. So he does both. Can physicians have the luxury of that hour? And I'm just using that very euphemistically, an hour to see somebody. And insurance does not pay for physicians to see a patient for an hour. They may have an occasional consult, but it's not on most insurance plans. So what a lot of the physicians that train with me do is they will take a Friday, let's say, and not see any gynecological patients and have three or four couples an hour each, or an hour and 15 minutes each, sit with them, and they do the sexuality counseling with their medical expertise. I mean, that's top-of-the-line work. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. And the next best is to have the physician or the naturopath work with a sex therapist, and you and I have done that, clearly.
Right.
When I was at the Sklar Center for Women's Wellness, I would do, the first step really was a session with me, the psychosexual evaluation.
Right. Oh, that's great. Yeah.
And I looked at the psychological aspects of the patient's journey to wellness, and I would identify for the rest of the team the emotional and relationship issues that needed to be addressed during the treatment, in addition to their life stresses and their symptoms of depression or anxiety, their couples issues.
Right.
A history of religious or family attitudes about sex and the details of current sexual functioning. And then we had Susan Sklar, who's a gynecologist.
Wonderful guy.
We had a traditional Chinese medicine evaluator, the PA person, the nutritionist. So this is very helpful, particularly for women's sexuality, which is often so much more complex. The woman, if she doesn't like her husband, she's really not going to benefit from sex therapy.
Naturally, if the relationship, we see the relationship as a barometer.
Yes.
Of is there going to be pleasure? And if there's anger in the relationship, if there's resentment, if there's rejection sensitivity, the way somebody speaks to you, or if you feel like you're being used, male or female, I believe, I really believe, don't have their heart and soul into being lovers once they are angry and once they feel objectified. And so for women to have a combination of that kind of integrated medicine, that kind of team, I mean, that's outstanding. And the fact that you did the first interview is an excellent model, because you could then say, you know, the relationship is great, Dr. Sklar, but there's something going on with within her body when you examine her, and you could mention certain issues such as pain or discomfort. And so I'm not sure how the Chinese medicine person works with that, or the nutritionist, but what were some of the things that you learned from that practice?
Well, the nutritionist, a lot of menopausal and postmenopausal women are really frustrated. They're often, they've gained weight. They're not eating well. They're not exercising. And so the nutritionists would go over what they eat and make suggestions. It was really a lifestyle assessment.
A holistic practice.
Yes. And
that is the way it should always be. But
yes, holistic.
We're just coming up. We're just coming up. Sex therapy is a field that has not been teamed in an integrated way the way we would like to see it. It's still not. Don't you agree?
I do agree. And our nutritionists worked on a lot of other health issues, and that included chronic illnesses, hormonal imbalances, diabetes, fatigue, and immune deficiencies. And then she would suggest diets, herbal remedies, and of course that was the Chinese person, Chinese medicine person who did that too, and supplementation. So it really was multidisciplinary, a real team approach.
Right,
fact,
I love that.
It's expensive to do it, and I think hopefully we're going to see more of it. But so far, it's pretty rare. The most you get is what I do. I collaborate, as I've said before on this program, with Dr.
Sure.
Serena McKenzie, a naturopath, and that
now,
works very well.
When you, I do know her, and I did train her in one course I taught. She's a wonderful person.
Yes, she is.
But now, naturopathy, as it's called, does that mean that she does not use traditional Western medicines?
No, she uses the best of Western and Eastern medicines.
Okay.
Her Bastyr University for naturopaths is pretty much as hard, as I understand it, as going to medical
school.
And so she can prescribe all of these medicines. She's legally can prescribe. That works very well, because again, it's the mind body approach, and
the mind is our big sex organ.
It sure is.
That's why women are enjoying reading erotica, because it puts their imagination and their mind in a sexier place than worrying about doing the dishes or where are the kids and, you know, whatever people worry about. There's hundreds of things that people worry about. So erotic imagination is always overlooked. How many physicians, when a woman says, no, I don't have much desire, will say, you know, I want you to read something erotic. I want you to relax and know about your body and see what turns you on. Even if you would never do anything that's written in the book, read a book that's somewhat scintillating to you. How many physicians might say that to their patients?
Well, I don't think very many, except all but the most
the ones
educated and illumined, and the ones who are just with it and understanding and kind of comfortable. Now, you're going to be interviewed by what paper shortly about the book 50 Shades of Grey?
A local paper here in Palm Beach, Florida. I'll send you the link once it comes out.
Oh, good.
But the question is, why is this book number one on the bestseller list for so long, and why are women reading it, and then why has it become the super terrific way that people are now initiating sexuality? You know, why a gynecologist will say, throw away the creams and the ointments, read the book.
Yeah.
Because the mind is reading about something sexy, and obviously you might not want to do anything that the book describes, but you're finding it erotic, and those erotic thoughts in the brain go right down little transmitters down your spinal cord, and they excite the reproductive organs, even if you're past reproductive age. They excite you. The thoughts become transmitters of sexual arousal. And so reading something or seeing a romantic movie or something sexy is the way to keep focused. And that's what I'm going to say when I'm interviewed. That's very different than being mindful. I know you use the word mindful of your imagination is one thing, of your sexy thoughts, but being mindful of what you're doing now and what's my body responding to is distracting. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, you're saying it's a little different. The mindfulness is a little different with erotica and reading.
Mindfulness, as I understand it, and I just took one wonderful course in Chicago. But mindfulness, as a psychological new buzzword, means being aware of your body and how it's responding.
Yes, it does.
I believe there's lots of terminology. We could discuss that for another hour, but that's what I understand. But also being relaxed and being in touch with what's going on in the room. But it seems to me, and I'd like to hear your opinion, that it is definitely not in the same league as being mindful as you're reading an erotic book and you realize, oh, my God, I'm feeling something in my reproductive organs here. What's going on just from reading this book? Because that's not being mindful. That's allowing your brain to go into the limbic system, into the erotic system. It's very different. It's a different brain system.
And of course, we're learning more and more about the brain ever since the 1990s when brains started to be looked at with functional MRIs and so on.
MRI, right?
Yes, and so we're learning more and more. At the last Quad S conference in Los Angeles, this was Western Regional, Quad S listeners is the Society for the Scientific Study of Sexuality.
Right.
And we had Dr. David Linden, mm-hmm. who is a neuroscientist at Johns Hopkins, and he talks about in his book, The Pleasure Compass, about the pleasure circuits in our brain, and now we can see when they light up. And certainly reading something sexy is going to excite those pleasure circuits. And I imagine it is a little different. I'm not sure exactly how it's different. But
let me just say this. That whether or not you can see the action in your brain, mm-hmm. you certainly know that when you're reading something that is making you feel erotic in your body, you could be that person in the book you're reading. You could imagine that these things are being done to you. You might not even want the same sexual pleasure that's in 50 Shades of Grey. It's more of a dominance and submission, and that might not appeal to you. But somehow, just the fact that somebody's wanted and loved affects you. And so you're not there. You're in your mind. It's you know exactly what I mean, and we've all known this since we were kids, since the first time we were aroused by something we read or something we saw on television, or, again, with the Internet today, it's so available that men and women are being aroused by things on the Internet, which can be good or bad, depending on, you know, what you're looking at.
And how much you're looking.
Right. When it becomes habitual, when it takes the place of the sexual pleasure that you can enjoy with your partner, then it becomes distressing,
and it is a problem. And we've both worked with they're really men who become very compulsive about watching pornography, and
It's available,
and
it is totally not mindful. It's totally that man that's watching the screen mm-hmm. is in another part of his brain. He's in the pleasure center of his brain, and he's not being mindful of, gee, my wife's in the bedroom waiting for me, or he's in an escapist kind of mode, if you know what I mean. Now,
sure.
Escapism. Or being immersed in sexy thoughts is great when you're in the middle of a sexual activity. But if you're just doing, if you're always on a screen with it, then it becomes something else.
You don't have the human interaction. It becomes
right, exactly.
much easier for the man to just masturbate and look at the screen,
right.
and then his expectations. I mean, the woman on the screen is always enthusiastic.
Right.
We always know how it's going to end.
Exactly.
And it is not realistic. And so his expectations about his own partner or partners changes. And
I think that's very true.
Yes.
And
his brain changes in the process if he's watching it enough. There are subtle changes in his brain.
Right. You could say that, but also your humanity, the part that's human, doesn't exist anymore for you because you're so used to interacting with pictures. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, of course.
But it's more of a problem.
We had Nina Hartley on one of the panels.
Right.
And it was a porn panel, and the main message there was, porn is not sex education. It's fantasy. And anybody who thinks that they can get a sex education from watching porn is mistaken.
Uh-huh. Right.
It's all about fantasy.
Right.
It can be a nice add-on. Some couples will watch porn together.
Right.
I've always appreciated my friend Candida Royale's films because they're female-centered.
Uh-huh.
Females are always her femme films.
Uh-huh.
While they're explicit, females are given a lot of pleasure.
And a lot of power.
And a lot of power. Thank you for mentioning that, Susan. That's right. They're given a lot of power.
The whole idea of being submissive is really very distasteful for a lot of women. They don't want to be told what to do and ruled by a man. So those women would not be interested, I don't think, psychologically in reading or watching something where they were being objectified.
I agree. But in the case of Candida Royale's films, she uses real couples whenever she can.
Mm-hmm.
And most women watching porn, they'll look at the couple and say, well, how come this couple is having sex? How come they're, we can use the word on this internet, how come this couple is fucking? Because they like each other. They're in a relationship. And most women need that kind of context.
Right. Exactly.
To enjoy it.
I think we can talk and talk about women, but I think men need love and they don't they might not need it to have an erection and an orgasm. They might not need it or even care to have it, but it's when a man loves and is being loved, I think that's the height of being mature and being able to express himself. It's just that people don't always speak about men as needing love and nurturing and special treatment. You know, it's always the woman. And we are woman-centered because we grew up with that in this, you know, from being in the, trying to understand ourselves. But I think men
need a lot
of love.
Susan, we should be talking just as much about men. And if you envision love as a triangle, on one side of the triangle is commitment, and that is the cognitive side of love, where you decide to commit. Another side of the triangle is intimacy, and that's the emotional component of love.
Right.
And then kind of at the base of the triangle is passion, and that is the motivational side of love. If you have passion, man or woman, man and woman together, you're much more likely to have an enduring relationship where you have all of those things working, the commitment, the intimacy, and the sexuality, the passion.
That makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense, except in other cultures. Just had a woman whose first sex therapist I trained in Jamaica. And she's a doctor. She's brilliant. But she said in her country, people have babies with one woman, then they're with another woman, women with other men, that there's polyamory in that country.
Mm-hmm.
And it's recognized. It's recognized. It isn't, I guess people are always jealous and insulted if somebody goes off with someone else. But a polyamorous society is very different than our society, or Western, or our country anyway, where it's monogamy is sort of as the ideal.
Well, that's very true. And another one of our presentations at the Quad S meeting was on the bonobo monkeys. And, and they have make love, not war, and so they solve a lot of their conflicts by having sex, and it's boy monkey on girl monkey, it's girl monkey on girl monkey, and they rub their genitals together, and they're shown to be having orgasms. They just have a lot of sex, these monkeys.
Well, they're very smart, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
And you're very, very wonderful and intelligent for having this show.
Well, thank you. I'm so pleased.
This is informative, helpful. Certainly being with you, I always feel relaxed that I can speak about what I teach and what I know, and there's always something to learn. That's why we're always going to conferences and meetings and learning new things, because in our field, it's ever-growing.
It really is, and we need to be positive role models too, and knowledgeable with our clients, with our patients.
I'm hearing
some music, Susan, which means no. We need to stop a little before the top of the hour because they play promos of other shows. So let me thank you once again.
You're so welcome.
Dr. Susan Lee, and listeners, I'll put it up when I describe the show for the archive, but you...
Thank you so much.
We'll want you to go to www.floridasextherapyinstitute.org. Once again, Dr. Susan, thank you.
Thank you, and hope to see you soon, dear.
Well, we will. And I'll have you back for another part. Bye-bye, everybody. Telefonerai probabilmente a me tuo schiavo.